Once again, I'd like to have you turn with me this evening to 1 Corinthians and chapter 11. While you're turning there, I certainly want to thank you on behalf of my wife and I for a lovely month here in Nassau. We always enjoy the fellowship and of each of you as you go out of your way, I know, to make our stay here very comfortable and relaxing and enjoyable in every way. Also want to salute the guys in the Haven. Keep your eyes on the Lord, brethren. For only when you keep your eyes there will you go and follow Him. Always enjoy being involved in the Haven when I'm here, getting to know some of the young men. Unfortunately, I don't come back normally often enough to keep, there's always new guys there, but it was neat to come back, within a 6 month period this last time and, see some familiar faces that I met in November as well. And trust that you'll all go on to the Lord. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 2. And the reason I start here is the fact that it says, "Now I praise you," and that is the indicative key in all throughout this book of 1 Corinthians that signifies a new subject. It is that little phrase, "Now I praise you, now concerning the things you wrote to me, now concerning the things I've heard." This is the indicative phrase. It starts with "now" each time through, and that's why I choose to start with verse 2 of 1 Corinthians chapter 11. "Now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the ordinances, as I have delivered them to you. But I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. Every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonoreth his head. But every woman that prayeth or prophesieth with her head uncovered, dishonoreth her head, for that is even all one as if she were shaven. For if the woman be not covered, let her also be shorn. But if it is a shame for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her be covered. For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, for as much as he is the image and glory of God. But the woman is the glory of the man. For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Neither was man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. For this cause ought the woman to have power on her head because of the angels. Nevertheless, neither is the man without the woman, neither is the woman without the man in the Lord. For as the woman is of the man, even so is the man also by the woman, but all things of God. Judge in yourselves, is it comely that a woman pray unto God uncovered? Doth not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a shame unto him? But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given her for a covering. But if any man seem to be contentious, we have no such custom, neither the churches of God." Last week we broached into this subject, frankly, in this passage. And it was just a couple of things that I want to reiterate again. We talked a lot last Sunday evening about interpretation and the fact that we want to interpret this literally because we interpret all the rest of the scriptures literally. And thus we would want to apply all the scriptures and interpret them all in the same way. I have a problem with the allegorical interpretation of scriptures because I never know where it becomes allegorical and where it becomes literal, and it seems to switch back and forth. However, in a literal interpretation of the scriptures, it is consistently literal all the way through, and that's a whole lot easier for guys like me, which don't have all these wonderful theological degrees. And so I have to take it simple, and so I take it literally. The next thing we talked about at great, well, not at nearly the length that I would like to have talked about, is the distinction there is in the teaching of the church between the teaching that surrounds the universal church, that is, all those who have been saved from Pentecost to the rapture, and the teaching that surrounds the local church, that is, a group of believers gathered together in one location. A couple or three or four of those differences is the fact that the teaching surrounding the universal church is individual in responsibility. And it's the corporate responsibility would be involved in the local church. In the universal church, we have, if you will, positional truth. Those truths which are true of every believer with no distinction on whether he's mature or immature, whether he's male or female, and none of those kinds of distinctions are in the teaching surrounding that which is true of all the church of God. However, in the local church, we have distinctions made, distinctions in gifts, distinctions in maturity, distinctions in male and female, and that is around the local church teaching. Also involved in this is, since the universal church is not seen in its entirety, never in one spot, well, I suppose you could argue that it was seen in one spot at one time on the day of Pentecost, but since that particular day, until we all get to heaven, what a glorious day that will be, when all the church will be gathered together surrounding the throne of God, and then it will be manifest in a very real and wonderful way, as Ephesians 5 would tell us, as a glorious church without spot or wrinkle. What a glorious day that's going to be when we all get there. However, in the local church teaching, we have that which is visible. Those things which can be seen, because the local church has a visible testimony in the immediate surrounding locality in which it is placed. And thus, things that are visible are seen in the teaching surrounding the local church. And of course, we have been talking about the idea of symbols. And that is why the symbols surround the idea of the local church. And thus, we have these symbols that are here in chapter 11 of 1 Corinthians. We have four of them. Two of them, unfortunately, we are not going to get at all. We have the two symbols in the last part of the chapter are bread and wine, which are involved in a corporate meeting of the church, where we have the visible symbols in front of us of the bread and of the body and the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ, and we gather around those visible symbols. And we remember the Lord Jesus Christ in his own death, burial, and resurrection in his own appointed way. At the front of the part of the chapter that we have read together, we have two more symbols that are visible. One of those symbols is that gadget that sits between your shoulder blades, and we call it a head. And in this chapter, we will note that it becomes a symbol. It is taken as a symbol. And also there is another symbol, and that is a covering, a veil, which is to cover the ladies. And that is a visible symbol. Just as visible in the negative sense of the word, and just as important, is the uncovered head of the male. And because it is uncovered, it becomes as important as the covered head of the lady. One can't go without the other. And so this is what we have here in this chapter. Now, for sake of time, we're going to have to run through this relatively quickly. Please excuse me if I just run through this. I'm going to try very, and I'm looking at my wife when I'm saying this, I'm going to try very hard to stick very close to my notes, which is not normal for me. But we're going to work real hard at that so that we can get through this by 7 o'clock. I wish we had another 2 hours of teaching and about 2 hours of questions and answers after that, but I have a feeling that by midnight tonight, maybe all of you would be more tired. Anyway, we won't do that. So, bottom line is, what we're going to look at, and I'm going to try to give this clearly and concisely, and what I see in this passage to help us understand it is the fact that I see three heads. I see three glories. And I see four arguments. Now, maybe everybody won't exactly break it down the way I do, and that's fine. But this is the way I'm going to break it down for tonight. We have three heads, we have three glories, and we have four arguments. So, very obvious and clear at the beginning of the chapter, I mean, you don't have to look at this chapter very hard to understand we have contrasted here. Male and female is contrasted. Long hair on the female, short hair on the male is contrasted. Covered females and uncovered males is contrasted. Males, females, covering, not covering, long hair, short hair. These things are simple, they're on the surface, and all of them play a part in this particular passage. And it is these things that are going to be weaved together in the subject of headship and in the subject of glory. And he's going to give us four arguments that are very precious and solid for this subject. Now, the statement that Paul makes at the beginning, he argues, as Paul always does, very tightly, very interconnectedly, very like a lawyer would argue. He begins by making a statement of fact. That's verse 3. And then from verses 4 to 7, he's going to give you his first argument. And that argument is going to be theological / spiritual, if you will. You can call it either way. I'm not going to get upset about either way. Verses 8 to 12, we have argument number 2. And he is going to argue from creation. And then verses 13 and 15, he's going to make a third argument, and that's going to come from nature. And then verse 16, he's going to have one more argument, the weakest in one sense and yet very important. He is going to say, this is the teaching of the church, period. In other words, he's going to argue, if you will, apostolic authority. And he saves that one for last. And I think with very good reason. So verse 3 is the statement of fact, which reads, but. It's interesting, it starts out with but. This is a very classic yes, but. Verse 2 is a yes. Yes, I would praise you. Yes, I would praise you because you remember me in all things. You bear me in mind. I praise you because you keep the tradition, the ordinances. That's an interesting word, the word tradition. Used in the New Testament negatively and at times positively. Basically used negatively more often than positively, because there's a lot of negative traditions out there. There's traditions of our fathers which may should have been thrown overboard a long time ago. And the New Testament is filled with that idea. But there is tradition that is used in a good sense. And it is that lifestyle, that thing which I do in my life, which in fact will reflect the teaching of the apostles. And those traditions need to be held to from generation to generation. I would refer you later to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 15, and 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, and verse 6, where that word tradition is used in that sense. But, that's where we start verse 3, you see? But, I would have you to know. Here's something that maybe this church wasn't understanding. Obviously, from the teaching, they didn't understand. And it is something that maybe we don't understand. It is something that we need to understand, and that is this. But I would have you to know that the head of every man is Christ. I find it fascinating because that's where he starts. Now, normally in a progression, because we have three heads here, the head of every man is Christ, the head of the woman is the man, the head of Christ is God. Now, I would have assumed that we would have started at the bottom and worked our way to the top, or we'd have started at the top and worked our way to the bottom, but that's not what he does. What he is saying here, and this is the emphasis of the passage and the emphasis of the book, and that is that Christ is the head of the church. It is Christ. Glory. It is Christ, the purchase of His blood. It is His will. It is His name that needs to be honored in the church. And the bottom line here is the headship that we want to visibly demonstrate here is the headship of Christ. Now, he would also go on to say, on top of that, also, that in fact the head of the woman is the man. And also, the head of Christ is God. And I find that very important in this passage. And I'm so glad that the Spirit directed Paul to put that there, because it is an argument that is necessary for our day, because we tend in our culture, in our day, to think that somehow submission equals inferiority. That somehow if I'm submissive to someone over me, that makes me a second-class citizen. And in fact, if that is true, then I would have to argue that Christ is inferior to God. And brethren, we had better not go that way. Because there is equality in every sense of the word. He is God. In every sense of the word, co-equal, co-eternal, He is God. And there is nothing in His being which is inferior. And may I add, there is nothing in the female being that is inferior to a male being. And we need to understand that. We are not talking about inferiority of being. We are talking about ranking. We are talking about headship. There's got to be a captain in the ship. As Commander Waddell discovered, that no matter what happened and what mistakes were made by men under his command, he was the guy who made the decision, and he's the guy who gets retired from the Navy. And that's what we're talking about here. So if this is the picture, this is what we're trying to say here. We're trying to say that Christ is the head of the church. Okay, fine. Now, for Christ is the head of every man. And the head of the woman is the man. Now we're going to go on to say, in verses 4 to 7, we are going to have, if you will, a theological argument for that. Or at least a spiritual argument. In verse 4, we start out by saying that a man praying or prophesying, covered, brings shame. That is a very strong word. Dishonor may not be as strong as it needs to be there. It brings shame on his head. Ask verse 3, who is the head of the man? Christ is the head of the man. Okay, the second thing he says is a woman praying or prophesying with her head uncovered brings shame, same word, brings shame on her head. Who is her head? Verse 3. The man. Now he goes on and he reiterates that. He says, because if a woman isn't covered, let her also be shaved bald. But if that is shameful for a woman to be either shorn, that is to have a close-cropped hair, or shorn completely, I mean cut off completely, bald type, if that's a shame to her, well then, she better be covered. Now that's the basic argument. There is your spiritual argument. We say here in verse 7, we wrap it up by saying then, why is this true? What is the reason for these two sentences? Why is he saying that? Why is this true? Well, here's why it's true. Because a man indeed ought not to cover his head, for as much as he is the image and glory, here's our first glory, the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man. Now we have to ask a question here, and we'll get back to this maybe at the end. We will get back to it at the end, pretty quickly. We have to ask the question, in what sense are we talking? In what sphere are we talking? May I suggest that on the surface, we must be talking about the context of the local church, because what we're talking about is covering and uncovering. That's visible. We're talking about males and females being together here and displaying this. That's corporate. And we're obviously making a distinction between males and females, and that becomes local as well. So we're talking about the area of the local church. We're in that sphere. We're not in the sphere of the universal church. We're in the sphere of the local church. Now, let me understand what we're saying here. We said here, because the man is the image and glory of God. Now, that's interesting, isn't it? The image means representation. He represents. Glory is manifestation. We have representation and manifestation. And it says here that the man is the representation and the manifestation of God. Now, in creation, it's interesting that we go back to Genesis chapter 1, and both equally, both males and females equally, are in the image and likeness of God. But that's not what the apostle says here. He says the image, the representation, and the glory, the manifestation of God. But, on the other hand, the woman is, he doesn't go, he's not in the image here, isn't he? He skips that because what we're dealing with is manifestation. What he wants to bring across is the idea of glory, the idea of manifestation. And it says here that the woman is the glory, the manifestation of the man. In other words, as the man manifests God, so the woman manifests the man. That's fascinating. Because what is this is being manifested by the covering or the non-covered head. In other words, we have that the head is to be covered of the woman because it is shameful, if you will, for a man to be seen or visible as the head in the church. So actually what we're saying here is the man's physical head is in fact used in these verses as a symbol, as the manifestation of the headship of Christ. Therefore, it needs to be uncovered. Because he manifests the headship of Christ, and the head becomes a symbol as well. Now, on the other hand, the woman's head is a physical symbol, used here as a physical symbol. And her head becomes the manifestation of the headship of man. Now, obviously we're dealing with the local church here. We can't be dealing with the family here. We have to be dealing with the local church here. And when she covers her head, then what she is saying is man and his headship is in fact covered in the church. Because there can be only one head in the church. There is only one head in the church, and that is Christ. And this is a visible demonstration of the one head in the church, and that head is Christ, not the man. No man can be head in the church. For when a man takes headship in the church, we have a two-headed church, and that becomes a monstrosity. Now, that's the theological argument. The creatorial argument is this. Paul argues headship on the basis of creation. He says in creation, and he goes back to Genesis chapter 2, very frankly, he argues here that the man was not of the woman, but the woman of the man. You go back to chapter 2 to find it out, of Genesis. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. Therefore, you go back to Genesis chapter 2 and you discover that, and I don't have time to do that tonight. You will have to do that at your leisure. But one of the great lessons that you want to underscore in that is you will discover in chapter 2 of Genesis that God created man out of the ground. And He created the trees out of the ground. And He created the animals out of the ground. But He didn't create woman out of the ground. She came from man. She was of him and for him. And in that act is established the headship of the man in creation. And that's a long argument. I wish I had an hour to get into that. But there we go. Therefore, in verse 10, 4, this cause, ought the woman to have power on her head because of the angels. Interesting verse. Tough verse, not an easy verse. Lots of different ideas on this verse, by the way. But may I just suggest this? Therefore, because this creatorial reality of which the angels are aware, the woman needs to demonstrate visibly for the angel that she in fact understands and is submissive to the authority that God has placed in the universe and in mankind. Well, at least that's my take on that verse. You may have different ones. That's fine. I wish we had 2 hours to discuss that, but we don't. So the angels learn from the church. They learn a lot of things from the church. They learn some things in Ephesians chapter 3. And here they learn, as the saints gather together, they learn that authority and headship is being displayed, and the head is Christ. And that's what is displayed for the angels to understand. Argument number 3. Are we moving through this fast, or are we moving through this fast? Turn up, like I say to the folks in Grand Rapids, turn up your hearing aids. I'm going to speak fast from here on in. The third one is nature. I want you to understand that this is an argument from nature, not culture. This is an argument from nature and not hairstyle. Folks, you and I both know that hairstyles on men and women have gone up and down like hemlines on women. But that's not what we're talking about here. Because Paul is not going to argue from culture. He is not going to argue from style. That is not what he's arguing here. Not once in this argument he's come close to that. So what do we mean from nature? It says here, in verse 13, judging yourself, is it comely for a woman to pray unto God uncovered? Now here's where he's going, doth not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a shame to him. Same word as dishonor. But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given her for a covering. Now I want to tell you a little story. It's only taking me 30 seconds. We're going to have to say this real quick because I was struggling with what we meant here. And I will never forget, as I was struggling through this, it was a number of years ago. And I was struggling through this, thinking it through, trying to figure this passage out. And I was having coffee between meetings in the morning
in my home assembly back in Grand Rapids. And this brother walked in, and he had on a dark blue suit. He had on a white shirt. I forget what his tie looked like, but he had the brightest red vest that I have ever laid eyes on in all of my life. And the very first thing I thought about was the fact that he looked like a robin. I mean, I have all kinds of crazy thoughts go through my head, so you got to forgive me a little bit here. I thought, man, he looks like a robin coming through that. And just as I said that, that's the answer! We're dealing with nature here. May I give you a lesson from nature? Who is covered in nature? The female or the male? Now, this word covering here in verse 15 is not the same word. It has no relationship to the word up in verse 7 and 5 and 4 and 6. It has nothing to do with that. It's a different word altogether. It's a word that means vesture and is translated vesture. It's translated garment. That which is thrown about you as a vesture or a garment. The woman is covered in nature. There is a vestment, a garment that surrounds her, that designates her, and everyone in the world knows that this is a female. I go out hunting when I was a kid. I was hunting for years and years and years and years. I used to go pheasant hunting when I was a kid. And you walked through the cornfield, see? And you had you could only shoot the male pheasant. And I tell you, it didn't take you a nanosecond when that pheasant flew up between the corn rows to know whether that was a male or a female. Because a female, you could hardly see her. She was covered. She was a female. She was covered. Now the male, well, you're just saying, you got the green and the red, a beautiful bird. I mean, how many of you have seen pheasants? Absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous bird. And in just a nanosecond, you figured out this is the male. He was uncovered, wasn't he? He was there for all the world to see. The female was covered. And I don't care in what species you go. To my knowledge, not somebody out there is going to give me a species that this is reversed in or something, but in nature, we have the bottom line. We have the females covered and the males uncovered. Now he said, that's what nature teaches us. Now how is that demonstrated in humankind? It's demonstrated in humankind with the long hair of the lady and the short hair of the man. For you see, if a man has long hair, I don't care what your stylist says, he is looking like a female. I want you to go to the grocery store. Take a grocery store. Pick any grocery store. And look at the glamour magazines. You don't have to buy one. Just look at the front cover. That's all. Most of what's inside of it, I presume, is nonsense. But you look at the cover. And all the cover girls. In all the glamour magazines. They got short hair or long hair. You know what kind of hair they got. Because it manifests the radiance of the glory of the lady. And there was a radical feminist as I was flipping through channels the other night up in the apartment. And it took me about 30 seconds of listening to her to know that she was a far out radical feminist and her hair was shorter than mine. And you will find that in the world around about you. What is Paul saying here? In nature, there is a distinction. He created us male and female. And men ought to look like men and females ought to look like females. and that is done with long hair and short hair. And the long hair is for her manifestation that she is female and deserves to be treated like a female. And she comes under the covering. It's given to her for a covering. Now, are you still contentious? You still want to argue about it? Well, okay. You want to argue about it? Paul says, bottom line is that there is no such custom in the church. Now, wait a minute. It isn't the custom of males and females being distinct and covering and uncovering. That is not what Paul is talking about here. And you can read any other translation outside of the King James and it makes it a whole lot clearer, by the way. This contention about males and females and their distinctive roles and the reality of headship is not to be contentious in the church. The Word of God is to be honored and obeyed and lifted up. And there is no contention about what the Word of God teaches. What we need to do is be obedient to it. Now, I have to answer a couple of questions. I have emphasized in my teaching this evening that this is in the context of the local church. Why do I say that? I say that because it is visible, and that is a clear clue of the local church. It is men and women gathered together. And it takes both men and women, by the way, to demonstrate this principle, does it not? The uncovered male is just as important to this demonstration as the covered female. You need both. In this section, Paul begins at a very foundational truth, the truth of headship. And that is very closely connected with lordship, by the way. And what does he do? He begins in verse 17 to specifically talk about the fact that when they were gathered together to have some sort of a fellowship supper, they were not gathering together for the Lord's Supper, even though they were calling it that. And he begins in specifically to give them teaching concerning the Lord's Supper. He argues from the general, if you will, the foundational principle, to the specific. He does that in Acts, in Romans, 1 Corinthians chapter 8 through 10. He argues from the general in chapter 8, an idol is nothing. We know that an idol is nothing. All these things are a bunch of stone. There are no gods except one. But boy, by the time he gets to chapter 10, when he's specifically arguing the idea of separation and fellowship, he suddenly gets very specific and he contradicts himself. No, he doesn't. In chapter 8, he's talking general. By the time he gets to chapter 10, he says the idol is something because that which, when those people bow to those idols, they're bowing to demons, and we cannot be associated with demon worship. He argues from the general to the specific. He argues from the general to the specific. In chapter 12, he starts out with spiritual gifts, and when he gets general in chapter 12, motivation in chapter 13, and then he gets to the specific in chapter 14. What Paul is doing is arguing from general to specific in 8 to 10, chapter 11, and chapter 12 through 14. Now, that says that I need to interpret verse 5 for us. And I know I'm overhand, but since this is my last day, you can't do anything about it, because I'm leaving tomorrow anyway. But I won't keep you very much longer. I have to talk about verse 5. Now, I have good brethren. I've chatted with them for hours on this subject, right, frankly. And they will say, well, the local church begins at verse 17, and in verse 11, or chapter, verse 5, means that there is a place for women to pray and prophesy, but obviously not in the local church, which would be true in verse 4, in chapter 14. Now, when I argue these things, I have to argue from the clear to the unclear. I mean, I don't care what subject. You talk about the assurance of salvation, the eternal security, And I got verses in the New Testament that make me wonder if I got eternal security or not. But I argue those in light of the clear verses, don't I? Now the bottom line here is the fact that if I argue for a place for women to pray or prophesy, but not in the local church, I must have teaching in the New Testament that tells me when and where they are to pray and prophesy. And may I inform you that you can't find that. There is neither principle, precept, or practice of women at any point and in any situation outside of the family situation and in the home praying or prophesying. Now, if the local church chooses, which we have done over the years, chooses to have gatherings which are not contemplated in the New Testament, and we have a number of them. We have ladies' meetings, we have youth meetings, we have Sunday schools, we got a bunch of them out there. Now when, and I'm not saying it's wrong or right to do that, that's not my question here. But if the local church chooses to do that, then the local church needs to choose how they are going to conduct those meetings. And since I don't have a biblical example to tell you, that is for the elders of the church to figure out for themselves, given the wisdom of God. Now I know I have just raised all kinds of questions, and I wish I had 3 hours to answer them. But I can't find, but we need to be careful that what I'm going to do tonight is I'm not going to interpret a verse in light of something that there is no pretext or principle or practice in Scripture to do. Therefore, I must interpret it in light of the fact that Paul is talking about praying and prophesying for the men, so he turns around and talks about praying and prophesying for the ladies, because what he is aiming at is not the praying and prophesying. That's left to chapter 14. What he is talking about in this section is headship, and headship only. And he wasn't going to confuse the fact by talking about praying and prophesying in the same text. But when he gets to chapter 14, then he will discuss praying and prophesying.